This podcast from the 2010 Maine Festival of the Book, an annual festival organized by Maine Reads, is brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council.
The reawakening of Ayn Rand with author Anne Heller. Ayn Rand is capitalism's Helen of Troy, the mind that launched a movement. Her novels, The Fountainhead, from 1943, and Atlas Shrugged, published in 1957, set hundreds of thousands of feet marching to the beat of irrational egoism and laissez-faire capitalism. Her vision of a world composed of proud, productive, heroic men and women who make their own way, follow their own drummers, and require no help from a power-driven welfare state is once inspiring the American right at a time is once again inspiring the American right at a time of large-scale government intervention in our economic and social lives. Rand's courageous life and fierce, if faulty, conviction illuminate her time and ours. Anne C. Heller, the author of Ayn Rand and the World She Made, has written for such publications as Lear's, Mademoiselle, Tri-Quarterly, and Esquire. And I was thrilled when I opened the New York Times November, December, and there she was featured on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, and I thought, here's a person I want for the book festival. So I tracked her down, and here she is. She is the former fiction editor of Esquire and Red Book and a former executive editor at Condé Nast Publications. She lives in Manhattan, and here is Anne Heller.
Thank you, Sarah, and thanks for having me here. I'm glad to be in Portland, Maine. I'm Ayn Heller. No, I'm not. And I'm speaking on an introduction to socialism, or anthem, for altruists. Just kidding. It's true that Ayn Rand is more popular now than perhaps ever before. I've been told that in 2009, all of her books together, including some nonfiction books that you may or may not know, sold 1 million copies. But mostly, that was made up mostly of Atlas Shrugged and secondarily The Fountainhead. And she certainly never had that kind of sales in her lifetime, although she was very popular at times in her lifetime. I thought I'd talk about why she was popular in the 40s and 50s and 60s and went underground and is now newly popular again. Ayn Rand, let me tell you a little bit about her. As a child, she told her mother that she expected to be greater than Columbus. And her mother reminded her of this in a letter written a few years after she came to the United States at the age of 21 and was having a hard time establishing herself. She was an awkward, brilliant little girl who had very few friends, who rebelled against everything she didn't like and loved violently, as she put it, the things she did like. And these included a lot of things Western. She loved Western German march music, and she loved operas that showed Western scenes. She loved American and German films when she was a little bit older. And she longed to get, even before the Communist Revolution, she longed to get out of Russia and come to a place where, as she put it, real people live. She was 12 years old when the Russian Revolution happened. Her father was a pharmacist on Nevsky Prospect in St. Petersburg, which is a big commercial street. And a few weeks after Lenin took over St. Petersburg, the Red Soldiers, who were really, there was just a mob of people who became the soldiers right after the revolution, came by and looted her father's store and threw him out and shuttered it and put red banners over it. And her father basically never worked again. She happened to be in the store when this happened, and as you can imagine, it shaped her life and her thinking. So she came to the United States in 1926. She was 21 years old. It was the dollar decade, and she loved America. She just loved it. And then, and she worked briefly in Hollywood. If anyone wants to know anything about that, I'll answer questions later. Then the Depression came, and socialism reared its ugly head, and she was terribly concerned about whether America was going to go the way of European countries who were turning more and more to socialism, and most of all, the Bolsheviks. And so she wrote The Fountainhead, and it was published in 1943 as an ode to individualism of a kind that she thought of as American, but it was not really American. How many of you have read The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged? So you know about Howard Rourke and his insistence that he will create what he wants to create as an architect and not have any truck with anybody else, any of his clients. He thought of himself as being like Frank Lloyd Wright, who said, I will build what I want and the clients will come to me. So he, in 1943, of course, it was the end of the Depression, the beginning of the Second World War, and the world had been, the United States had been ruled by Roosevelt for many, many years, for almost a decade. Huge influence in creating regulations about industry and finance, some of which I must say we're missing today, like the Glass-Steagall Act. A welfare state that took care of anybody who could take care of himself. There was unemployment, Social Security. Many of those programs began with him. And although he was a wildly popular guy, there were a lot of people in the United States who hated him and who embraced Rand when she published The Fountainhead as a voice, as a powerful voice against a concern for the collective and for a concern for the individual who should have all the liberties promised in the Constitution and maybe a few more. Rand was known to the libertarian right in the 1940s. When she published, and she was celebrated by them, she was a very popular figure among the conservatives of the time, whose names you might or might not recognize, but Albert J. Nock and H.L. Mencken were of that kind. When she published Atlas Shrugged in 1957, she more or less did for capitalism what she had done for individualism with The Fountainhead. She made it heroic at a time when it was not heroic. Everybody said it's the best of a set of bad choices. Ayn Rand said it is the best system ever devised and the only system that protects individual rights. And so she became, for a while, a darling of the right, post-war right, the William F. Buckleys and the Russell Kirks and National Review and all of those kind of people, who were very much marginalized at that time. They didn't really have a big following. But they were Christians, and they thought that capitalism and democracy ought to be based on the rights granted to men by God in the context of a Christian religion. And Ayn Rand was a militant atheist, a foaming at the mouth atheist. The first time she met William Buckley, the story goes, at a party, she said to him before he said anything, Mr. Buckley, in her Russian accent, deep Russian accent, you are too intelligent to believe in God. And he having a sense of humor, you know, thought that was pretty funny and told that story many times. But eventually, as she was so insistent on that, that eventually Buckley and his tribe cast her out. And she formed her own system. She became the leader of a early libertarian cult. It was a cult and not a political movement because she called all the shots about what to think, what to say, how to say it, what to read, what not to read, who to marry. And the people in this cult, young people mostly, really thought they ought to be characters from her novels. They, you know, compared them. How am I going to decide what class to take? What class would John Galt take? Or Howard Roark? Should I be attracted to this woman over here? Are her values good? How does she compare to Dominique from The Fountainhead or Dagny Taggart from Atlas Shrugged? So it became a very intense system, at least in New York. And it spread. And Rand's views of individual rights and of free markets with no regulation became quite popular on campuses throughout the country. And through Alan Greenspan and Ron Paul and Christopher Cox and people older than that worked their way into the various administrations, like the Nixon administration. Rand was partly responsible. She was the inspiration, let me put it this way, for Nixon ending the draft in 1973, and we haven't had a draft since then. This is the nice part of Ayn Rand. She argued that the ultimate, you know, break with individual rights is the draft because it's taking away the right to live and stating implicitly that an individual person owes his life to the state. And she did not like that idea very much. Ford, of course, took her mentee, Alan Greenspan, into the government and made him head of the Council of Economic Advisors. And then later, of course, he became the head of the Federal Reserve Board. We can talk about that in a little while. And so gradually, not Ayn Rand herself, but her ideas and her followers crept into respectability. She herself, when I began this book, was still not talked about with anything but trepidation or contempt by people. She's been an outcast in the political and the literary worlds forever. But now she's back, and she's no longer an outcast, and I'm as surprised as I can be by this. Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and, let me see, who else? The Wall Street Journal, all sorts of conservative publications are invoking Ayn Rand as the spokesperson for the American way of life and against the intervention. Once again, we're in a period, as Sarah said, where government is growing, it's intervening more in people's lives, and Ayn Rand was truly the most eloquent spokesperson for why we should not let the government intrude too deeply into our lives. So she's back. But what made her anathema finally to the 1950s and early 60s conservatives is not being taken into account at all by people like Stephen Moore of the Wall Street Journal and all the people who are calling her name, and Tea Party people who are holding up signs that say, "I am John Galt," and Atlas is shrugging, and things like that. I don't know that they've read her, because they're also having prayers before they start their tea parties, and they're, for the most part, anti-abortionists and, you know, pro-Iraq war. She was against, like the old-fashioned classical liberals, she was against getting involved in wars where American interests were not obviously and directly at stake. So I am predicting another reaction against Rand soon. But for the moment, what what she really has done, and I'm not a believer at all in her political preachings, but what she has done is clarify some of the issues at stake between security, both economic security and national security, and freedom and creativity. Those were her great themes. And those were the reasons why I wrote this book, because I was very interested in exploring those and making up my mind what I thought about her and her contribution to the discussion that we have on those issues. That said, she also led a fascinating life. And since I haven't talked about that, I'd be very, very happy to answer questions about that if people have questions. Let me wrap up by saying that Ayn Rand was a cantankerous person who alienated people all her life and ended up dispersing the cult movement that she built, which was gigantic in the late 60s, and being left with two or three people who cared for her, and fundamentally dying alone. And, you know, a biographer has to judge the ideas that drive a life by the shape of the life that's lived, and by those means, her philosophy was not a successful one. The people who I interviewed for the book were either intensely devoted to her still, I mean, the people who knew her, and these were older people, people in their 70s and 80s, or more often, bitterly angry about their time with her and about what they considered to be her betrayal of them and of their loyalty to her, personal betrayal. But they continued to admire her and think of her as the biggest influence in their lives. So she was a very, complicated personality and character who led a controversial and complicated life. So can I now ask for questions? The question is, how did George Orwell influence Ayn Rand? George Orwell wrote 1984, as you know, in 1948, which people have compared a lot to Anthem, which was Ayn Rand's second novel. It's a short little novel about a time when an atomic war or some catastrophe has allowed a totalitarian dictatorship to take over the world. In her case, the setting is a world empty of technology, when all technology is forgotten, and when the concept of the word I has been forgotten. Characters talk about we, you know, we do this and we do that, and these are the rules for us and we. Love is not permitted, and invention is out of the question. So Ayn Rand believed that without freedom, there could be no economic or technological progress, and that was part of the point of Anthem. The hero of Anthem rediscovers electric light and is in grave danger for his life and flees and starts a new civilization that will be inventive and free. George Orwell believed, based on 1984, that technology will aid totalitarianism, and that it does aid totalitarianism, and that that can be built and refined and made more repressive in a totalitarian society. One of Rand's beliefs throughout the Second World War and after was that it took Americans to build the atomic bomb and to create... We've created everything in the 1920s through the 1940s, and she thought that was because we were free. Does that answer your question? And, of course, Anthem was published in 1938, 10 years before George Orwell. That's the key. They were both influenced, it is thought, by a writer named Zamyatin, a Russian futurist who wrote and published in the... He didn't publish, but he wrote in the 1920s, and pirate copies of his books were floated about. Hi.
You a minute ago, and I believe many people sort of characterize Ayn Rand as a libertarian. I've seen that many times, and what I've read, there are some similarities. However, the Ayn Rand Institute, and particularly Peter Schwartz from the Ayn Rand Institute, my impression is they reject that concept. Of course, her philosophy she calls objectivism. I'm not sure I understand all complete what objectivism. I think it more of individualism. But anyway, the Ayn Rand Institute says that Ayn Rand was not a libertarian. We reject many of the philosophies of libertarianism. I'm curious whether in your research of Ayn Rand, whether you think there's any distinction between Ayn Rand's objectivism or individualism and libertarianism.
That's an interesting question. Ayn Rand was the mother of libertarianism, the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian Movement, the contemporary Libertarian Movement, really arose out of Ayn Rand's followers. However, she hated the Libertarians because they rejected parts of her philosophy. For example, they had no philosophy of romance. Ayn Rand believed that you couldn't love anyone properly. You couldn't be a proper person and love anyone whose value and values were not objectivist values and value. And the libertarians didn't really want anything to do with that. They didn't want really to have a theory of the origin of morality, which Ayn Rand did. And she thought they were plagiarists, and that she refused to have anything to do with them. The Ayn Rand Institute and Peter Schwartz take her view. They've defended her views on everything since they've been in existence. Personally, I think that Ayn Rand was a great articulator of libertarian principles, and when you read her books, you find them everywhere.
Take advantage of the microphone since it's right here. I think I may have tried to read one of her books, but I don't have the patience. And I was just wondering if there's an Ayn Rand for dummies?
I think there is, actually.
Really? I think that's what I need. Yeah.
I think there is one. Type it into Google.
Yeah. I came here because of him. I really don't know what it's about.
A lot of people have a problem with her novels, especially, you know, if you start with We the Living, which was her first novel, it's a much more realistic tale with realistic characters. It's autobiographical, and it's really a beautiful novel.
On a lighter note, what was she doing in Hollywood?
She spoke no English when she came to the United States. She went to Chicago. She came to New York, to the New York Harbor. She hopped on a train and went to Chicago, where her mother had distant relatives who lived and took care of her for 6 months. And then she fulfilled her plan all along, which was to go to Hollywood and become a screenwriter as a way of learning English. It sounds really weird, but it worked, because in 1926, we still had silent films. So all she had to learn to do was to write the little dialogue boxes and things. She screamed, or, he laughed demonically, or whatever it was. On her second day in Hollywood, she had a letter from her relative in Chicago who owned a movie theater in Chicago, a letter to the Cecil B. DeMille organization. And she immediately went there to try to get a job, and she was turned down. She was dressed in these dark Russian clothes. You can just picture her. I mean, she was small and stocky, and she looked foreign. And the story she told was that as she was walking dejectedly out of the studio, Cecil B. DeMille came along in a touring car and said to her, "Who are you?" And she said, "I'm a new Russian immigrant, and I want to work for you." And he said, "Hop in," and took her to the set of King of Kings and gave her a job as an extra. And you can see her in if you know, if you've got a magnifying glass in the mob scenes that you know, the of King of Kings. And then he hired her as a junior screenwriter, and she lived in a place called the Studio Club, and one suspects she got a lot of help from the other girls who lived there. It was a YMCA, YWCA organization. But she learned very, very quickly, and everything she said she wanted to do, this woman did. One of her relatives said that knowing Ayn Rand as she knew Ayn Rand, the more likely story was that she stalked Cecil B. DeMille, fell down in front of his car and made him stop.
Yes, I saw a movie called The Passion of Ayn Rand. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you had seen that, and if you have, how accurate was the portrayal of her life in that?
I haven't seen it because I don't want Helen Mirren lodged in my head as Ayn Rand. I have heard that it focused mainly on her love life with her younger lover, Nathaniel Brandon, which did dominate a good part of the last part of her life, but which it doesn't reflect her accomplishments or her thinking. That's what I've heard about it. It's based on a book that was written by Barbara Brandon, who was Nathaniel Brandon's wife at that time. Ayn Rand was such a force that she decided she wanted to have a sexual affair with one of her followers who was 24 while she was 49. And he'd just gotten married at her urging to another one of her followers. And when she decided this and Nathaniel agreed, she brought her husband and Nathaniel's wife into her living room and spent the next 12 hours telling them why this was necessary, why she needed this, why it was right, why, according to the philosophy that they had all embraced, it was inevitable that Nathaniel with his values and she with her values, or her with her values, or whatever it is, would come together as a sexual pair. And by the end of the night, they'd all come to a conclusion that they would do this, and not only that, that the spouses and everyone else would keep it a secret. And they did. She said that it would last 2 years because she didn't want to be an older woman chasing a younger man, that inelegant spectacle. But it lasted 14 years, and it blew up in a really unpleasant way. But, that was Ayn Rand. She was honest. She valued honesty. She was honest in her way. But it wouldn't be what the rest of us might call honesty.
I have the mic here. It's been 40 years or so since I've read anything of hers, so the answer might be self-evident to anyone.
40 or 4?
40. I wonder if you could spend a minute or two explaining the differences between her view of objectivism and, say, the concept of anarchy. I don't understand how she feels about government regulation. Is it totally against all of regulation or just a little bit?
She wrote an essay about this called The Nature of Government, in which she explains that she was very angry at anarchists. That was another group of friends of hers that she got very angry at. She believed that government had a legitimate function. It had two legitimate functions. One was to defend the individual citizen against external enemies and crime within the country. So we needed a police force and an army. And the other one was to adjudicate and enforce contracts. And that other than that, all everything we do, buying and selling and building and demolishing, should be done by contract. And there should be no regulation of any business, industry, anything. She was for a completely free market. Now, I was talking about this with her physician who treated her for lung cancer when she got it as an older woman. And he said he asked her, he's in New York, and he said he asked her, well, if you're going to privatize everything, you want to privatize the schools? She said, yes. How about the roads? Yes. Well, what if a different person owned 72nd Street and somebody else owned 74th Street and every block, there was a toll booth on every block and you had to pay different vendors for this these private roads? And she said that would be just fine. So she was, you know, she was clear in her extremity on this subject. And what's the difference between that and anarchy? Well, the anarchists, at least the ones in the 50s and 60s, believed that we should do without government altogether. That we would raise a volunteer army by ourselves if we were threatened. That there should be courts for hire, private courts that would figure out legal problems. And she thought that was crazy.
Yeah. I'm curious about your personal evolution with Ms. Rand. What were your perceptions or opinions about her writing or her as an individual before you started writing your book? And how has that changed or been, verified through your research and writing of this book?
Well, you know, I was I went to Antioch College. That ought to give you some idea of, you know, what my politics were. And I didn't want to read Ayn Rand. I thought it had a spooky effect on people who read it. I preferred to stick with, you know, Herbert Marcuse and things like that. And I thought she was a potboiler writer. You know, I thought she was a grade C novelist who was really a propagandist in the old, you know, 30s way. And then I was in my, I guess this was about 8 or 9 years ago, somebody showed me part of Atlas Shrugged, and it went on for pages and pages. It was what's known as the money speech in Atlas Shrugged. And I was really stunned by how much I disagreed with it and how well argued and well written this thing was. I just couldn't get any purchase on it to poke holes, you know? So I thought, okay, I'll read the woman. And as I read her books, I became fascinated by the idea of this woman who was writing novels of ideas. They may not be great, they may not have great literary qualities, although I think they do. Most people think not. Many people think not, at least in my world. But I became curious about, A, what drove her, B, where she got these ideas, and the more I learned about her, the more questions I had. You know, I wanted to know, she claimed to have been born an American with this American spirit of freedom and individuality in her bones, and just born in the wrong place, Russia. I no more believed that than I had believed the theory that the Manson girls were completely hypnotized by Charles Manson and just killed people without any desire to do that themselves. I just think that that there's a natural order to one's growth and action, and that Rand had to be influenced by a Russian childhood and also by being a Jew in St. Petersburg at the turn of the century, which was probably the most anti-Semitic place in Europe, if not the world. And what was it like to grow up a second-class citizen for a woman as proud and fierce as Ayn Rand? So lots of questions emerged, and I really wanted to find the answers to them. And how did she change me? She said, anyone who wants you to sacrifice your interests to government interests, to state interests, wants to be the government or wants to be the state. And I haven't been able to shake off that perspective. I'm much more suspicious, wary, of government power than I was when I began writing about her, and much more aware of how individual liberties get traded for security and comfort when we let the government do things for us. I'm certainly no Tea Party person, but I am aware of that dichotomy in a way I hadn't been before. Does that answer your question?
Almost.
Okay, go ahead.
If you met her, do you think you would like her?
No. No, I'm so glad I never met her. I wouldn't have been able to write about her had I met her. I'm pretty sure of that. She just had such a strong effect on everyone.
But tell us a little bit about her personality and what about her was so both magnetizing. I mean, I'm familiar with her in a lot of what you said from before, but I haven't read her books. But about what about her personally, and I don't mean her ideas so much as her person,
mm-hmm.
and yet that was so repellent that drove people away and caused her to be alone when she was old.
What was attractive about her? She was brilliant, for one thing. She was working on an entire system that described the whole world. And she loved people with whom she could discuss these things that she was thinking. So that was very attractive to some people, many people, actually. And she could be charming, very charming, if you shared her interest in big ideas. She hated small talk. She was not good at it as a child. She was never good at it. So if people were talking about the weather or Aunt Molly or even, you know, something that was happening in town or something she wasn't interested in, she would just not talk. But if you were talking about something that she was interested in, she could be very charming and very smart. And later on, she had such self-confidence. People describe the surety, the sense of surety she had that she was right, she knew the answers. And that, to me, sounds unattractive. But it was very attractive to a lot of people. As she grew older, she grew more insistent that those who did not agree with her point by point by point were not only wrong-minded and stupid, but evil. Her world closed more and more. She thought she discovered the answers. Lots of people thought she had discovered the answers, but she really was cruel to people who disagreed with her and were dependent on her. Does that give you any sense at all?
If,
she was.
If I could come back to the government question, because I'm fascinated by Ayn Rand in part because I think that I spent 12 years in Congress, and I would define what goes on there as the split, the polarization, is not because we don't have dinner frequently or travel together or even because of the media or all the fundraising. I think it's really because the gap between what one side thinks and what the other side thinks is so deep and so profound that it is hard to understand the other side. I mean, for example, so my question really is, how does her idea of individualism fit, you think, or resonate with people today? Just by way of background, 20-odd years ago, a group of sociologists wrote a book called Habits of the Heart, which the central theme of which was that Americans have a first language by which they can explain their personal lives and everything that's going on in the world, and that's a language of individualism. Mm-hmm. There is a corresponding tension. There's another language. It's a language of community, mm-hmm. for which we sometimes aren't even able to find the words. Mm-hmm. But that split, that tension, is, I think, what drives American politics today. And so clearly, her
radical individualism has a profound effect on what's going on. And I wondered how you fit her into this larger political debate that's going on today.
Republican senators and congressmen often bring her name up, as I understand it, and talk about her devotion to rugged individualism, self-reliance, and other great American value, free markets, free minds, the wrongness of letting the government swoop us up and take care of us, and our losing our drive and our freedoms and our rights. I love the way you put that, a tension between individualism and community, because I do think the other side sees it as a question of community and doing for each other what needs to be done to make us healthy and part of a productive society. I must say that I'm skeptical about whether Ayn Rand is really so much in the minds of the people who talk about her, the Tea Partiers, and some of our congressmen and senators, because they don't follow through on the whole idea. They take bits and pieces of it, and they leave behind the godlessness and the pro-abortion feelings that she had, which are very much part of her philosophy. They're not extraneous things that just happen to be there and you can push them aside. I think she's very much hated by the other side, maybe for bad reasons. I must say I see it as a power struggle more than an ideological struggle. I might be wrong about that, but when I hear Ayn Rand mentioned or see her her principles stated, I'm just really hearing more of, more use of something as a, to gain power than I do respect actually for her ideas. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I would disagree on that last point, moment, because I think it's more of an ideological struggle than a power struggle, and that in fact most members of Congress believe very strongly in a set of ideas that they're talking about. And therefore, when the other side doesn't make sense, it's very hard on the biggest issues, not the small, but on the biggest issues, like, for example, healthcare, it's very hard to get agreement across the aisle.
We shouldn't be debating, but it seems to me that the Republican administrations spend just as much money as the Democratic ones on their pet projects. And although health care is a huge debate, so is, I won't get into that, but I don't know the answer to that.
I got the mic, so I got the power. During the period of the civil rights, when I was involved in it, the idea was that the federal government should intervene against the state governments for the sake of individual liberty. Mm-hmm. That's one part of government in competition with another part of government. Now, how would she feel about that? And what about her romantic ideas about the space? She liked that, but that was a collectivism for the corporation set up by government.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Her liking for the space program.
Oh, yes, she loved the space program.
But that's a collective.
It's absolutely any government-funded program, including the atomic bomb, which she also wrote a lot about, was it shouldn't be done that way, but she was really glad it was being done. And she felt that way about the space program. She watched the launching of Apollo 11, and she was thrilled to see that. What was the rest of your question?
Civil rights,
yes.
The government could interpose itself between the tyranny of the states and the individual.
She thought it was right for the federal government to enforce civil rights because she thought the role of the government in total was to protect people against the government. In other words, to protect individual rights against those who would take them away. So that would include state governments. So she was in favor of that, and she was very much in. Her anti-collectivism extended to anti-racism. She wasn't a feminist, but she had no question that women should be equal in all economic activity to men. So that was consistent in her thinking.
Who liked the mic?
Hi, I'd like to hear more of what you think about Ayn Rand and feminism and how the feminists today sort of view her. I see some similarities with her with Camille Paglia, for instance. With her and Camille Paglia, who are also very strong-voiced women, who a lot of feminists are uncomfortable to even acknowledge their brilliance at some point. So,
Camille Paglia is a, if that's how you say her name, is a fan of Ayn Rand. She's written about that. Well, Ayn Rand hated the feminists.
Why?
She just hated them. She hated that they were getting together and making all this, you know, fuss and not just going about their business. And she hated the collective demands, you know. You've got to do this for all women. And she made herself anathema among feminists when she wrote in the mid-60s, even before this feminist movement became strong, she wrote a column in the Los Angeles Times about why a woman should not be president. And this had to do with the sexual side, the romantic side of her philosophy, which said that a woman should be a man worshiper, that she wouldn't be a woman. She wouldn't be a real woman if she were at the top, because she needed somebody above her in order to be a real woman. So Susan Brown Miller called her a traitor to her sex, and I mean the feminists just don't like her. But she didn't want them to like her. She really didn't want to be liked. She didn't care about that at all. She went and insulted everybody at every occasion.
Yes, I'd just like to follow up on that, on what you said about her being a man worshiper, to ask about her relationship with her husband. Did she put him on the same pedestal? I mean, my understanding is that he was not as accomplished as she was, and so how she reconciled that contradiction?
He was a house husband after a very short while. As soon as she began to make money by writing, he had been working as a bit actor, and then when they moved to New York, he worked as a florist for a while, and he sold shoes. And she didn't like to see her husband do such work, so she encouraged him to stop once they didn't need the money. He was a very passive man, very good-looking, very elegant, and he took care of her. He was a house husband. He made sure that the shopping was done and the meals were made, and that the house was cleaned. He became a painter in later life, so he had a little studio to go to. But in some ways, he was a wonderful wife to Ayn Rand, and her younger lover was a wonderful mistress. It's a very male pattern. You know, marry someone who will take care of you, and, you know, who you're not ashamed to have on your arm as you go and meet the public. She was very insecure as a woman, and I think she clung to Frank, her husband, because he made her human, obviously human, in public. She pretended that he was that her heroes were based on Frank, and people who knew them together, knew them well, thought Frank was intensely embarrassed by her pointing out the ways in which he was like John Galt and Howard Roark, because he wasn't, and he knew he wasn't. But he stuck by her, even through the adultery. And so, you know, she had a wife and a mistress.
Did she write about the anti-Semitism she experienced in Russia, and how did that actually affect her philosophy?
You know, that's very interesting. She never spoke about the anti-Semitism she experienced in Russia or anywhere else, and she changed her name to a name that was, you know, very bland in every way. No ethnic associations, no... you couldn't even... Many people think Ayn Rand is a male. When she came to the United States, she knew what she wanted to do, and there was a lot of anti-Semitism here, too. She never talked about being Jewish, and she warned the niece of her husband, who was half Jewish, not to talk about it, and not to talk about where the family came from, because... you know, she should be embarrassed. That's a Jewish ghetto. Don't say that. And wouldn't introduce this niece by her whole name, would only introduce her by her first name. So my first thought was, oh, my goodness, she was embarrassed about being Jewish. But I don't think that was true. After the Second World War, she was much more open about it. And that was a period when you weren't limited in America by being Jewish. It's hard to reconstruct the 20s and what that was like, but it was a very different culture from the one we've got today. How did it affect her work? Well, if you think about John Galt as an inventor and a businessman whom is being, or Hank Reardon in Atlas Shrugged, who's being picked clean by the government and yet is expected to go on creating, I think that is a little bit like the conditions in Atlas Shrugged are a little bit like ideal for a Jew, for a European Jew of the 19th century, who also was made a pariah, but his inventions and creations of business and banking and so on and so forth were used by his adversaries. I think that sense of the sanction of the victim, productive people being victims of unproductive people, of backward people, it comes at least partly from that experience.
Could you speak a little bit more about the cult of personality disbanding? What precipitated that?
When Rand met Nathaniel Brandon as a 19-year-old boy, in 1949, he just fell in love with her philosophy and her ideas. And he invited his relatives, his cousins and mother and father and sisters, and also his acquaintances at college, to get to know her philosophy and to live by it. And so that was the beginning of a cult that really didn't take shape until after Atlas Shrugged was published in 1957. And then when she began to teach at colleges, I mean, not teach, I'm sorry, speak at colleges and universities, and when Nathaniel Brandon organized a school to teach her philosophy in New York, people flocked in. And all over the country there were Ayn Rand clubs and admiration groups, people who got together weekly or so to talk about her philosophy. In New York, the East 30s were, they all lived in the same neighborhood. The East 30s were filled with people who belonged to this movement. And I don't think she really wanted that. She was happy to exert power over these people because she wanted to keep them in line. She did not want them to besmirch her name, but I don't think she would have created this by herself. At the time, Atlas Shrugged was published to really wickedly bad reviews. And she felt that she had no people who understood her. And Nathaniel Brandon created this Nathaniel Brandon Institute to teach her philosophy in order to make her feel better about that. And it worked beyond anybody's wildest dreams and went on for almost a decade, by which time there were just thousands and thousands of people who called themselves objectivists. And then in 1968, when Rand found out that Nathaniel Brandon had a girlfriend who was 23 years old and a model, and he'd been lying to her about it, there was an explosion, and people were asked to take sides with Rand or with Nathaniel and blah, 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 and nobody, you know, nobody could deal with this at all. So the cult split apart and just disintegrated, basically. It was a huge dream almost in some ways.
Was she violent?
Was she violent? Only in her language. Although she did hit Nathaniel Brandon once at the end of their affair, and he deserved it. Yes, she was. She gave psychiatric care. She became, there was a cult, of, this was a cult of of psychology that developed. Brandon went to school and became a psychologist. He started treating all her followers. And then she got into the act, treating him and his wife and then, you know, some of her other favorites and, you know, not psychoanalyzing them so much as instructing them in how they ought to think and live. And it was like a disaster.
This podcast from the 2010 Maine Festival of the Book, an annual festival organized by Maine Reads, is brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council.